Sad day for me. One of my longtime colleagues, Mark Vosburgh, heads off into the sunset in retirement after today. I've been working with that guy for nigh on 30 years. I wish him well. It's This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I am Chris Quinn, here with my colleagues Laura Johnston, Layla Tassi, and Jane Cahoon, who also will be heading off into the sunset in a few months and will break my heart anew. This has been a tough year for losing good colleagues. I am going to record a special episode with Mark, which we'll publish at the end of the week, about the highlights of his 43-year career. Check back for it later.
I'd also like to add really quick, what a pleasure it's been to work with Mark, how smart he is, what a great wordsmith he is. And so I just wanted to say that real quick.
Yeah, I look, I cannot hold somebody in higher estimation. I've been privileged to be able to work side by side with him. We were a reporting team on investigative projects in Florida. We covered Cleveland City Hall together in the last years of Mike White and had a fun time. You know, the thing that struck me, I talked to him recently about his career, and the word he used was fun, that journalism, when it's done right, is fun. And that's what made it so special. So I know you're going to miss him, Layla. He's been, in some way, shape, or form, your editor for pretty much your entire career.
Don't get me going. I think I might cry today. It's really surreal. I mean, yeah, he's been, I'd say of the 18 years I've been here, he's probably been my boss for at least 15 of them. So, man, I'm going to miss him.
Yeah, yep. Meticulously careful writer, accurate, dedicated. I'm just one of the good guys. Let's get started. Who's the latest set of Northeast Ohio leaders possibly calling for a renewed federal investigation into the police killing of Tamir Rice? Layla Tassi, when this movement started, I didn't really think it had or would get much in the way of legs, but now it's starting to feel like this could happen.
Yeah. So the most recent group that's adding their voices to this movement are the Cleveland City Council. They will consider taking it up today. Councilman Kevin Conwell is expected to introduce legislation calling upon the Department of Justice to reopen the investigation. Listeners will remember that the federal investigation had dragged out for years before it was abruptly closed in the waning days of Donald Trump's administration. And then last month, Senator Sherrod Brown and House members Tim Ryan, Joyce Beatty, and Marcy Kaptur wrote to Attorney General Merrick Garland and asked for federal investigators to get involved in the case. And also last month, attorneys for Tamir's family asked Garland to convene a grand jury. Now City Council might add their voices to this call for justice for Tamir. Meanwhile, on the wrong side of history, the Cleveland Police Union just doesn't know when to quit fighting for the job of Timothy Lohman, the officer who shot and killed Tamir, and they're still appealing that case. So, this is moving in the right direction.
What's interesting is that before Donald Trump became president, the nation had a long series of consent decrees and the Justice Department was being aggressive in trying to curb police departments. And they launched this Justice Department investigation, civil rights investigation into the killing of Tamir Rice. But then Donald Trump became president. All of the consent decree investigations ended and this thing languished. And then very late, as Donald Trump was about to leave office, the Justice Department just summarily closed it without explaining why. And, you know, Tamir's mother was quite upset about this. So, hey, if all they're asking for is do an investigation, let the chips fall where they may. It'll be interesting to see if President Biden or Merrick Garland is listening. I would like to, as part of this, Jane Cahoon, talk about a different version of police abuse. A judge down in Columbus just slapped the Columbus Police Department silly with the ruling late last week. I've been saying for years that the Columbus police are completely out of control. And when they pepper sprayed students and our photographer a few years ago, they just come across like thugs. And this judge basically said the same thing.
Yeah, this is a federal judge, Judge Algernon Marbley, who issued an 88-page just stinging decision. And it bars the Columbus police from using tear gas, pepper spray, wooden bullets, and other so-called non-lethal force against nonviolent protesters. This was a decision in favor of 26 protesters who said they were brutalized by officers during a Black Lives Matter demonstrations last year. So as you said, he just slapped them. I mean, he said that some of the members of the Columbus Police Department had no regard for the rights secured by the First Amendment of the Constitution, this bedrock principle of American democracy. This case is the sad tale of police officers clothed with the awesome power of the state run amok.
Yeah, they've got to be the worst big city police department in Ohio, and have been for years. They beat the hell out of people. It's bad news. You know, if you want another telling factor about them, the Washington Post did a story, I think it published today, about how police departments across the nation have a low rate of vaccination, you know, which goes to the whole mental state about people with this. And Columbus police were cited as the low at 29%. Yeah. So if only 29% of the police officers are getting vaccinated, which they deal with the public. Think about what that says for the regard for the public. It'll be good to see if the mayor there is successful in getting the Justice Department to come in and try and do a consent decree like we've seen have such an improvement in the Cleveland policing. You are listening to This Week in the CLE. Why would a Stowe Municipal Court judge with 4 years left in his term be running against his colleague in tomorrow's election? Laura Johnston, this is just mean.
This is like small town politics, really. Makes your hair scratch your head. But Lisa Coates and Kim Hoover are the only two judges at Stowe Municipal Court. Their feuds are well known and long running. And Hoover, who has more than 4 years left on a 6-year term, is challenging Coates' run for re-election. And this is on Tuesday's primary election. They're both Republicans. There's no Democrat on the ballot, though a nonpartisan candidate could still file today. But tomorrow's election could be it. Hoover said he's challenging Coates partly because of Ohio law, which prevents judicial candidates from seeking office after they turn 70. He's 67, so if he wins her seat, he'd get an extra 2 years. But they've also had these feuds going back to like 2013 when Hoover asked a bailiff to check on a law enforcement database as a favor to Democratic power broker Wayne Jones. And that bailiff notified Coates, and she not contacted the Ohio State Highway Patrol, which did an investigation. Hoover didn't get in trouble about it, but there's bad blood there.
Yeah, he doesn't like her. He doesn't want her to be the presiding judge. And it seems like it's petty. It does extend his term for 2 years, so I kind of get that. But she's upset because she feels like no one's supporting her, right?
Well, right. And so she's actually has flyers urging Democrats and independent voters to go to the polls for the primary, request a Republican ballot, and vote for her.
Well, and if she loses, she could then run for the seat that he's vacating with 4 years left on it, right?
Right. But if he loses, he gets to keep his own seat. So he is a win-win.
Yeah, he's running for protection. It just seems awfully small-minded. If I live there, I'd vote for her just because I wouldn't.
You know what I think? Can I jump in?
Jane Calhoun.
Yes.
Yeah, I think Governor Mike DeWine, if Kim Hoover wins the election and his seat and DeWine gets the opportunity to appoint his replacement, he should appoint Lisa Coates.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is really
small-minded. Just stop the games here, right?
And this isn't just Stowe. I mean, because this isn't a mayor's court. This is 16 cities in northern Summit County. So that's a good swath of the county there.
Such childishness. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What do the pundits say they expect from Ohio's redrawing of congressional districts under the rules voters adopted to rein in gerrymandering? Jane Calhoun, this story depressed me, and I hope they're all wrong.
Yeah, I have to say it depressed me, too. But Sabrina Eaton talked to a number of analysts in the political world, and they had various opinions on, you know, districts that might be vulnerable to being absorbed during this process. But a couple of common and depressing themes emerged that basically Republicans are still going to try to limit Democrats to only a few seats, perhaps in the urban centers, and to basically try to stack the deck in their favor. They think they're going to likely forego working in a bipartisan manner to seek, you know, consensus on a map and instead just force one through with a simple majority, which they can do, but it would only last for 4 years under these new redistricting rules. So, you know, we might have districts that end up with a more regular shape, unlike the duck-shaped district of Jim Jordan or the snake on the lake of Marcy Kaptur, but they're still going to be dominated by Republicans. You know, Democrats only hold 25% of the seats right now, and that just doesn't reflect the electorate. A few other things just to refresh people's memories. We're losing a congressional seat in the next election, so we're going from 16 to 15. There's this new process that voters approved designed to produce fairer districts, and it's designed to have buy-in from the minority party. And as I said, to actually more accurately reflect the electorate, because the current map, Republicans just gerrymandered the hell out of it the last time. So, and then we're waiting for census numbers because they're delayed because of the pandemic. So Republicans might try to use that to their advantage and, you know, in use a compressed timetable to force this map through. The Democrats are very worried about that.
But I also don't think the pundits are looking at it as closely as they should, because they created those wacky districts like Jim Jordan's and Marcy Kaptur's because they couldn't do it any other way. And now, because they're not allowed to do that, I think they're going to be hamstrung more than the pundits think they are. Yeah, they can still make it lopsided, but I don't think they can make it as lopsided as it was. I'm going to be optimistic and count on it. The other thing is, we'll raise holy hell if it is lopsided, because that's not the way the state is. But those rules about making it more contiguous are going to be tough. And look, they wouldn't have made those ridiculous districts if they didn't have to. They did have to to be able to do what they wanted. So we'll have to see.
I think Rich Exner, our gerrymandering expert, would tend to agree with you that they're going to run into these rules, and it's going to prevent them from, you know, running the table like they did before. But we'll have to see. You're right. We'll have to be a check and balance on them. But in Sabrina Eaton's story, she breaks down a lot of these districts like Tim Ryan's and Marcy Kaptur's and Jim Jordan's and sort of what they expect to happen to them. So I'd encourage people to read that story.
Yeah, the prediction that you won't have a Democratic district in Toledo is the one that kind of throws me, because I'm not buying that. Or at least it'll be close. At least a good candidate could win if you had a good candidate.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a competitive district, you know. I mean, as voters, we shouldn't want Democratic districts or Republicans, but, you know, competitive ones.
Yes, I agree. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Does the abrupt resignation from Cleveland City Council of Phyllis Cleveland give hope to people who oppose putting an asphalt and concrete plant on Opportunity Corridor, which has been envisioned as a place for light industry and offices with high-paying jobs? Leila Tassi, this was a curveball Friday. It came out of nowhere, but does it offer some hope?
It did come out of nowhere. This is a very interesting development because, I mean, we don't really know where the next council person will stand on this issue. But as you said, Phyllis Cleveland resigned kind of out of the blue on Friday. She told our colleague Bob Higgs in an interview that she had an illness recently and that it gave her time for some reflection, and she decided her priorities had changed. She's been on council since 2006, and before her, Frank Jackson held that seat. 2006 was the same year that he was elected as mayor. So I don't know what this means for the Opportunity Corridor project. We've been talking about the project quite a lot lately because Frank Jackson is supporting this somewhat questionable plan to bring a construction training institute to an 8-acre site on the stretch of road, which would also include a concrete and asphalt plant. You know, the point of the 3.6-mile boulevard isn't just to connect 490 to University Circle. It's supposed to be to spur economic development in this kind of forgotten area of the city. And a lot of people who were involved in the acquisition of the land for this project are just so unhappy about this unsightly and potentially polluting asphalt and concrete plant, and the fact that Jackson seemed to have arrived at these plans secretly and unilaterally. You know, Steve Litt wrote what I thought was a great analysis a couple days ago, in which he said that Jackson's handling of this project could prompt other nonprofits assembling land in conjunction with City Hall to hold onto their parcels instead of ceding control because they don't trust the administration to do the right thing. And he also said that this first project will set the tone for whatever comes next at Opportunity Corridor. And he pointed out the irony that Jackson once squabbled with former Governor John Kasich over money to clean up brownfields in the area. Why do that and then create another source of pollution just a few years later? So anyway, that's not quite answering your question, but I just wanted to put it in a plug for Steve's awesome work on that. And to your point about Phyllis Cleveland, she was really largely in support of the project, but had said she needed to learn more at council hearings. And she's going to be able to nominate her successor. And the person she's picking, we're not exactly sure where she stands. Her name is Dolores Gray. She's a central resident and is very civically involved. But we haven't heard from her yet on Opportunity Corridor, and that'll be in her backyard.
Well, and they're all up for re-election, so this new person will have to gauge whether residents out there want this stinking plant messing up the environment for them. It's a good sign. There does seem to be some widespread opposition to this, and in keeping with the name of Opportunity Corridor, that opportunist Dennis Kucinich sent out a letter last night taking opposition up to the whole idea of the plant. He hasn't announced he's running for mayor, but probably will be.
You know what? This just sort of occurred to me now that, this idea of, I wonder how much the administration has actually touched base with residents about what they'd like to see in this area. It reminds me of the dirt bike track that also was planned for the central neighborhood. And when you start talking to residents about that project, they were so upset about many of them. We're very upset that the mayor wanted to put that right in their neighborhood with the noise and the light pollution and sound pollution. They felt like no one had listened to their concerns. And I wonder to what degree is this asphalt plant coming from that same place,
I think it's coming exactly from that place, but there's an added element in that the public has spent many millions of dollars building this road based on the promise of economic development. And right off the bat, we're getting a plant that will stop. Nobody's going to move there. Would you bring an office or a light industrial thing to that area with the asphalt plant spewing out the stink?
Not to mention the housing and the apartments and things that they could have attracted. Who the heck wants to live next to a place like that that's giving off dust and air pollutants? These are all points that Steve made in his piece too. Yeah.
It's also the road that was going to take you from the highway into University Circle. So for people heading into the Eds and Meds Center of Cleveland, they're going to have to pass an asphalt and concrete plant. There's nothing about this that makes sense. And I think it's interesting that the administration has refused for weeks now to talk about why they think this is a good idea. It'll become an element in the mayor's race, I feel certain. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What is the tragic local connection to the religious festival stampede that killed 45 people in Israel? Laura Johnston, it's amazing how often somebody from Northeast Ohio ends up being a part of tragic international news.
Yeah, this is really sad. This is a 21-year-old Cleveland Heights man named UC Cohn. He was among those 45 people who died in the stampede on Friday during the Lag BaOmer festival in northern Israel. He's actually the son of the 7th and 8th grade principal at the Hebrew Academy in Cleveland's Beatrice Yavne High School in Beechwood. So his family is pretty prominent there. But this festival is a popular pilgrimage among the ultra-Orthodox community, and about 100,000 people attended the event. It honors a rabbi who lived in the 2nd century and who many believe is buried in the area. At least 4 Americans died. Dozens more people were injured. And it happened around 1 a.m. when people were trying to leave, and they were congregated in this narrow tunnel-like passage, and then people got falling and slippery. And this is just really traumatic and sad.
Yeah, there's hell to pay now, because for years there had been warnings of this danger, that this was not something that was a surprise. And so people in Israel are demanding answers from the government and the religious leaders who sponsor this thing for why they didn't put in safety, because now it's got a true human toll. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. We're still way out from the U.S. Senate race, but have attack ads begun to run on the airwaves? And Jane Cahoon, it'll surprise nobody who's at the center of them.
Yes, it will surprise no one to learn that dark money is behind this first one. Although Andrew Tobias did try to shed a little light on the dark money. It's a group called the USA Freedom Fund that ran these ads, which boost former state treasurer Josh Mandel, and they attack his Republican opponents, former Ohio Republican Party Chairman Jane Timken, investment banker Mike Gibbons, and author and investor J.D. Vance. Now, Bernie Marino, businessman Bernie Marino, might feel a little left out because the ad didn't mention him. Maybe they just don't think he's a factor. But anyway, that
is that what it is? Is they don't think he's a factor?
Well, I don't know.
Or maybe he's behind it.
Has he teamed up with Josh Mandel to stomp everybody else?
Ooh. Who knows? Anyway, these ads ran during the they ran during the Kentucky Derby, and they had this kind of quirky equine theme where they said, you know, voters have to pick the winning horse, you know, a real thoroughbred like Josh Mandel. And then they go on to trash Timken and Gibbons and Vance for various reasons. And of course, it includes a clip of former President Donald Trump, who has not even endorsed in this primary, but we all know they're begging for his endorsement. A guy named Tom Datweiler is the treasurer for the USA Freedom Fund. He also happens to be the treasurer of Mandel's Senate campaign and the treasurer for Jim Jordan's campaign. But Andrew goes on to kind of explain, you know, that this USA Freedom Fund is a super PAC and it's allowed to accept and spend unlimited amounts of money to support political candidates as long as it doesn't coordinate with any candidate or party. And it is structured as a dark money group. And he lays out, you know, he peels back some of the layers involved in tracking, like, you know, they got one big contribution from a different super PAC. You just can't really figure out, you know, where the money is coming from.
You know, what's striking about this, every year when we write about campaigns, we always say, oh, the most expensive governor's race in history, most expensive senator's race in history. But we could actually have the most expensive senator race in Ohio history before the election year even begins. This is going to be a 2-year campaign. It started
mind-boggling.
The minute Portman said, I'm not running again. We keep thinking, okay, people say they're in, it'll go on a low temperature because there are other races going on, but it's not. I mean, it's like we're in the, it feels like it's an election year and nobody votes on this until the primary next spring. It's fascinating, but it doesn't surprise me that the first attack ads are on behalf of Josh Mandel, who is just one of the nastiest politicians we've ever seen in the way he attacks people. Even though this is Dark Money Group and he's not affiliated with it, it does share the treasurer, so there's right. Some kind of connection. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Why is former Cleveland law director Subodh Chandra facing a contempt of court hearing in Geauga County in the University Hospitals case involving frozen embryos? Leila Tassi, I'm a big believer that this case should not be secret the way the judge keeps trying to make it out there, but it sounds like Chandra did do something that gets him into trouble here.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people agree with you that filing these things under seal should be, you know, that's really keeps everything in the dark. But this all stems from Chandra's representation of Andrew Botnager, who was the director of the fertility clinic at University Hospitals back when a malfunction of its cryogenic tank left thousands of eggs and embryos non-viable. We're down to one of the final unsettled lawsuits against UH for this disaster. And Botnager had decided he no longer wanted to be represented by UH's attorneys. So he hired Chandra, and together they filed this scathing affidavit blasting UH for hiring an incompetent and negligent staff at the lab and accusing the legal team of all kinds of bad stuff. It was that document, the affidavit, that the Geauga County judge had ordered removed from the public docket. Most of those filings have been done under seal because of worry that too much information about this case spilling into the public could taint a jury pool. But critics like you, Chris, say that if filings are under seal and this case settles like the rest of them, the public will never know what really happened. And that was the spirit of this 25-page affidavit that Chandra filed on Botnager's behalf. It really publicly laid bare Botnager's version of events. Well, the judge ordered it removed from the docket, and Chandra refiled it 2.5 hours later and then released this public statement that says Botnager, quote, is determined to ensure that patient victims of the UH fertility disaster at long last know the truth about what happened. So it seemed very much you know, in defiance of the judge's decision to have that removed from the docket. So he's being called to a contempt hearing on June 21st, and he's retained his own legal representation for that. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, and look, the problem he faces is the judge did seal his filing, so he knew that the judge did not want that out in the public. And when he refiled it, he said he wanted to remove a patient's name because in his original filing, it included something that shouldn't have been there. So legitimate reason to refile it, but knowing that the judge had sealed his original filing, to not file that under seal, you're going to get in trouble for that. The judge is going to say, you openly defied what you knew were my wishes. You shouldn't have done it. And while I salute him for pushing this into the public sphere, he said in one of the hearings, if ever there was a case that should be in the public, this is it. And I agree with him. I think it's horrendous what this judge is doing to protect the hospital at the expense of the people knowing what happened here. It's just, that's not her job. She's supposed to represent the public. She's elected by the public, and she's being the stooge for the hospital. But it sounds like Subodh Chandra exposed himself to some trouble here.
Yeah, it does. I wonder, I mean, could there have been another way for Bhatnagar to have told his story? I mean, are they all under gag orders? I think now they are, but you know, before that, could he have, been a whistleblower in a way that would not have gotten Subodh into trouble here?
Yeah, I think he could have, when he hired Subodh, they could have just put out a statement saying he's severing himself from the hospital team representation. Because,
right.
You know, and here's my, finally, I'm going to tell you what happened. Here's my statement.
Right.
But by doing it this way, you keep it under the purview of the court. And again, the Jaga County judge is way out of line here. We're going to have to do some things to bring some pressure to bear because the job is to represent the public, not the hospital.
Exactly.
You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How far out of proportion to the state population is the number of Black judges in Ohio? And what are a couple of the judges trying to do about that? Jane Cahoon, this is one where lots of organizations, including our own, are working to have their staff reflect the population they serve. The judiciary in Ohio clearly does not.
No, it does not. Of the 723 judgeships in Ohio, only 56 are held by African Americans. That's 7.7%. And you asked about the, in relation to the population, that's much lower than the 13.1% of Ohioans who are Black. So a new organization has formed at a time when they say interactions between racial and ethnic minorities and the judicial system have reached an inflection point. And so the goal of this new group, which is called the Ohio Black Judges Association, is to not only boost the number of Black judges on the bench, but also serve as a collective voice to address social and racial injustice. And Ohio 8th District Court of Appeals Judge Emanuela Groves is the incoming chair of the group. She said they're committed and passionate about their responsibility to have a distinct role in addressing issues regarding the administration of justice. They believe that their collective voice will be impactful. The leaders of this group were recently sworn in by Ohio Supreme Court Justice Melody Stewart, the first Black woman elected to the court. And Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor seems to support this group. She's pointed out the need to increase diversity in the bench as well as within the ranks of lawyers and magistrates. So she told this group it would create new value within our justice system.
Yeah, I wonder if part of it is awareness to kind of sow the seed into the minds of some of the Black lawyers in the state to put in for the job of judge, that it's a service to make sure that defendants come in, find judges that look like them, because largely they do not. Many Black defendants find themselves in before white
judges. Right, and lawyers too.
Yeah, so we'll have to see. It's a good move. I hope it's successful. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. That'll do it for another Hot Monday discussion. Come on back tomorrow for another discussion of the day's news. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Jane. Thanks to everybody who listens to the podcast.